We're in chapter 26 of Matthew. He's normally the first, you see, almost invariably. Well, they sang a hymn. I wonder what they sang. And then they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them that they would all be offended. Peter avowed that he would not be offended, never. And Jesus said, "Yes, you will, before the cock crows. You shall deny me three times. Though I die with you," verse 35, "I will not deny you." And they came to Gethsemane. And here you have this, I suppose, when you tread this path, you are on sacred ground. So sacred that unless you really feel you've touched it, you just may as well just not defile it with your sticky mind. Here he is in verse 39. He's got the... Or verse 38, he said, "And then my soul is exceeding sorrowful." And here's the side of God that is something we know little of, but it's the sorrow of God. It's the incredible sorrow of God. Now remember, there was no pain on him, no nails in his hands, no cross. But here he is in a fathomless sorrow. How deep is that sorrow? To the point of death. Now, I remember telling you that when I was in Romania 2 years ago, there was a terrible accident, a car accident, while I was there. In the church I was in, and a woman lost her husband and her two daughters, and the man's brother also died, but that wife was left. I don't think she had any other children. And we had to go, and of course the whole visit was then redirected, and we were now the comforters for the family, because the whole village was involved, and everything now was revolving around this bereavement. And I was there for a couple of days, and then we had the burial. And all I remember is that the mother, the woman who was bereaved, was so filled with sorrow that on one occasion, I saw her twice, but on one occasion the pulse was going down so low that they took her to hospital. She was beside herself with sorrow. She couldn't face it. I've never seen anyone like it. Of course, you sit there, you hold a person's hand, and what do you say? You say the obvious things, that's all you can say, and you sit with them and so on, and you sit with the family, and you seek to find words that point them to the mercy and the kindness of God. But it's sorrow, isn't it? Now, there's an example of it, but you know that this night, all over this world, not known to us, but there is incredible sorrow. I don't know how many homes in Britain will be filled with sorrow this night, but there will be many. But over the world, and it will touch every one of us at some point, incredible sorrow. No one can escape it. But the thing that we find most baffling is that the one who suffers most, or let me put it this way, not suffers most in the sense that God doesn't suffer poverty himself and all this, but because of his love, he suffers with the human race. There is no doubt that the greatest thing about God is that he feels the sorrow of mankind. And I suppose that's what prayer is all about. Intercessory prayer. Not that you feel all the sorrow of mankind, but somehow you enter into the fellowship of God's sorrow. Jesus said, this sorrow is so great, it's almost leading to my death. He says, I'm at the point of death. Now, you know that he sweat great drops of blood. It says that in Luke's Gospel. But here he is in a pure agony of sorrow. Not the agony of nails, not the agony of thorns in his brow, the agony of compassion and love. Identified with a lost world. That's why I say, when you tread this path, you are on holy ground. One hesitates because it's so holy. In one sense, you feel that you ought to say, well, let's just say that all that God wants is that we should partake of it. God wants us to somehow partake of his sorrows. If I could put it this way, God wants those who observe him. That's what he wanted. He wanted these three men to be witnesses of him. He wanted them to stay awake to watch him. He didn't want them to stay awake to say, oh, we've prayed, or to say, we've done this, or say, well, God redeemed the world tonight, we prayed it through. You know, you hear people say that. We prayed through and God healed that person, you know. We've got thousands to pray, and then after thousands have prayed, God healed them. There's something so wrong about this, unbiblical. We prayed. We prayed. What did we do? What did we really do? It's a terrible thing to draw attention to us. All he wants is witnesses of him. Remember that the great thing of prayer is that you become a witness of God. It's so easily misunderstood that you become a witness of his great, great love, wherewith he loves us. You become a witness of his glory, of his greatness, of his magnificence, of his... You spend a moment, you see a glimpse, you see... What do you see? You see holiness, you see wonder, you see... But at some point, you see sorrow. Because he's a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Now, he says, my soul is so sorrowful that it's even unto death. And he says to the Father, O my Father. He's praying now on his face. It says in different accounts that he went and fell on his face. He fell to his knees. It's another. It's just this. What you find is this. This man who is prostrate before God. He's cast himself down, throws himself before God, and prays. And he says this, "Oh, my Father." Now he didn't pray much, and you remember he prayed this prayer on three occasions. And it was the substance of his prayer that lasted for 3 hours. It wasn't that he was repeating it. It was what he held before his Father. He said, oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup of sorrow that's killing me pass from me. Bring me through the sorrow to the cross. Bring me through the sorrow. Sustain me. Till the cross. He wasn't saying, I don't want to die. He wasn't saying, don't let me be crucified. We know that, because that was his whole life's direction. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears to him that was able to save him from death, I add through sorrow, and he was heard in that he feared. In other words, God answered his prayer in that he feared God. Notice that the reason he was answered was because he feared God. Now, I've said these things to you, and it's there, isn't it? You can see it. Here he is, Father, if it be possible, sustain me through the sorrow. Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And here you have this, what you have, it's the mystery of it, because remember that he wasn't asking for the cross to go from him. If you want to pinpoint this too much and make it into a sort of an answer, an explanation, you'll have missed the point, because remember that there is in this whole prayer a great mystery of agony, pure agony, that's bringing him to death that is premature. It's almost going to kill him. And he doesn't want the agony to go from him, because that's what he's come for. He wants sustaining in it, through it, to the point where he has accomplished the salvation of the whole world. It's a mystery. And what you find in it is this, is that you don't fully understand why or how the prayer was answered, except that this was part of the process of Jesus Christ's preparation for the cross. Submission to the Father's will. Because in one sense, though the cup was held back, it was not taken from him, you understand? It was not taken completely away. He still drank the cup, but the cup was the cup of the sorrow and sin of the whole world. You understand? What I've pointed out to you now is that this is beyond a simple human explanation. This is simply there Christ in his humanity. And remember that this account does not occur in John's Gospel, very interestingly. Gethsemane is not recounted in John's Gospel, where it's the emphasis on his divinity. But here he is, agonizing now to the point where he's going to die. And he's praying, and Luke tells us that an angel appeared to him, strengthening him to bear through this that was almost mortal in the garden to the point where he could die. All right, well, enough said. Let's move on. He comes to them, and they could not watch with him. I suppose the greatest grief of God, or not the greatest, but one of the griefs of God, is that there are very few who will watch with him. One of the tragedies of God is that people interpret prayer as the means for blessing. It is, of course it is. But there's a point in prayer when you go to the Lord not for what you want, but for what he wants. All right? They didn't do it. I'll die for you, Lord. Wonderful. Could you watch with me as well? You know what it is? It's this thing, this agony. Here he is. He wanted witnesses. Now, again, one has to be... the thing is, here you've got a realm in all his ministry, in all his dealings, in all that he had done for all these men that he'd preached to and healed and blessed, and all that he'd done, remember this, that in the end he didn't have one who watched with him. Not one. The interesting thing is, and we're all humbled here, I'm making no claims. It's a fearful thing to see these things and preach them. How many does he have in Britain today? Does he have three? Does he have one? Does he have 100? Does he have 200? You can start to answer it by asking yourself, how many does he have in Epsom? You're left with a realization, most people pray for what they need. Few know what God wants. These are things that he had three and they didn't fulfill it. I'm just pointing it out to you. If God could call out into our hearts tonight, one of the things we'd do, well, he would say, well, I want you near. What do you need? What do you need tonight? Well, let me tell you that God dwells beyond your need. You find God when your needs have been met. You understand? He lives on the other side of human need. You can find him in human need, but you really discover him beyond it. There will be no needs in heaven. There'll be none. It's strange, isn't it, these things? All right, now. He says to them, he comes and says, now sleep on. And Judas comes, and we've already mentioned this. It's the whole atmosphere has changed. Not in his heart, but here he is now. Wake up, he's rise, let us be going, he's come, he that will betray me. And so he comes, and this traitor ostentatiously kisses Jesus. This is what the word means. It is not just kiss, it is he covers him with kisses. That's what Darby said, isn't it? Darby said, covered him with kisses. Another translation says, I've forgotten which one it is, ostentatiously embraced him. And he said, rejoice, Master, and ostentatiously embraced him. And it's this whole realm that was, oh, Lord, but it was all treacherous. He'd already left him in his heart. Then comes the moment when one of them, Peter, we know, drew his sword and cut off the high priest's ear. Well, what a... It's the violence, it's responding to violence, responding to this carnality, responding to Adam, because this is Adam come now, this is the conflict. He that is born of the flesh persecutes him that is born of the spirit. And here's Adam rises up to defend Jesus, if you like. It's just contradictory, it's all wrong. It'd all descend into a battle. It would become Muslim in the end if it had gone on like that. The Muslims are, I don't know what kind of man he was. He was obviously, well, he was a false prophet. But they spread it by the sword. Christianity has often become that in the history of the world, spread by the sword. No better than the Muslims. The only thing that you can point people to when they quote you that is that that is entirely foreign to Jesus Christ. And it is entirely foreign to the New Testament. It is a total denial of everything he stood for. But you must not forget that in the defense of Jesus Christ, I'm not saying he needs defense, but you understand what I mean. When you're preaching him, you must never try to defend Christians. Many Christian practices have denied the Master. Many Christian symbols of our day, cathedrals, institutions, many things have denied our Master. The Crusades is one of them. You point to what is Christ-like. You don't point to Christianity. You understand what I mean? Of course, it's not Christianity. That's the point. It is denial of Jesus Christ. And remember that, and I point you back to this again. I've forgotten the date of it, 300 and something. I'm sure it was before that, actually. But the first date that was marked when the church killed the Christians, the first martyrs at the hands of the Christian church, when the true believers started to be killed by the churches. You understand what I'm saying? Anyway, he picked up a sword and thereby denied him. Denied his spirit. And he cut off the ear. And of course, this is what it does. It makes people deaf to the true Christ. Cut off their ears. We said this the other day. If you take a person who's trying to hear the gospel and you give them an ear full of aggressive evangelism, you're likely to close their ears forever. There's a moment when you witness forcefully, and there's a moment when you just gently, meekly love. But anyway, then it goes on that Jesus said, I've come here, and they... Anyway, the point is that they all forsook him and fled, and then they take him to Caiaphas. Peter follows afar off, and they held their council, verse 59. The chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Now watch it. This is organized religion. Watch it. Because it is not just the Jewish religion. It is any organization that in the end squeezes God out of itself. It has happened to virtually every denomination in the history of the Christian church. A denomination is founded in life. It becomes an organization. After time, it's rejected. First of all, it's persecuted. It has to form outside of the Christian church as a minority. It's there underground. It begins to grow. It becomes so big, it becomes accepted. It becomes an organization. And then the organization, in the passage of years, maintains its own form and momentum, which in the end squeezes out the life of Christ. Don't think we're looking at a historical event 2,000 years ago. We're looking at a tendency of the human heart. And they found... I remember in Cameroon, the mission grappling with a man who was a preacher of the gospel, but he would not conform to the mission statutes. And I remember that they in the end they had to drive him out of the church by their rules. It's terrible, isn't it? But this is what the churches do. I'm not saying he was 100% right in what he did, but the point is that often what happens is that the new life upsets the forms and the structures, and they have to change. Be willing to change. Be willing to change. This is part of it. Anyway, they held a council. It's the chief priests, the elders, the council, verse 59. And they wanted to put him there. They found no witnesses. This is the truth of Christ. You look through the Gospels and you find anything that's wrong with him. As I've said before, if a man wrote it, I'd like to meet that man. This is a perfect life. The reason that we know it's not invented is because it is known by the obvious fact of reading it. This is genuine testimony from four different sources describing real events. It's breathing truth. You find this. This is a perfect man. You cannot find anything wrong with him. And there's God put on trial. And remember that in history, history is the trial of two people, God and man. On the last day of judgment, man will be judged, but on that day also God will be judged. Do you understand? But of necessity. When a judge judges, he judges himself. You understand what I'm saying? When a man condemns an innocent person, he is himself guilty, obviously. That's why only God can judge the world. He's without sin. The whole history of the world will prove one great thing, that God is just and has never sinned. It will be proven. It will be seen. Have I ever told you this story that once there was a... it's an invented story about people standing before the throne of judgment. And they're talking about the judgment that's about to take place. And they're talking about God. And one of them is saying, I don't think this is right that God should judge the world. What has God done? He's never suffered. And so they say, well, we must put this to God, that if God is going to judge this world, he must first be born in it and live in a poor family. He must be a refugee. He must be outcast. He must be mocked. He must be a hated minority. And he must be maltreated. And in the end, he must be wrongly accused and mistreated and spat upon and condemned and given the worst form of execution that is ever known to man. And as they said it, they realized it's what God had done. And they said that's the only grounds on which God can judge the world. And of course, it's the truth. One of the reasons that God can judge the world is because he's done it. He sent his son. And here he is on trial. His first trial, they found none. Then at last came, verse 60, came two false witnesses. It says in another gospel that neither did their testimony agree. They couldn't make it stick. Somehow one of them said, he said in 3 days I'll build, and the other one said, was it? And then he came up and he said, I think it was in 10 days or something, and they couldn't agree. Whatever it was, they were all at sixes and sevens, and they couldn't seem to get it together. And in the end, the high priest arose because he was impatient. And he turned to Jesus Christ and said, do you answer nothing? This was against their law. Is it which these witness against you? It's interesting, their law, that the first ones to stone a guilty party were the witnesses. Of course, they were going to hand him over to be crucified. But if you had to switch the electric chair on the man you witnessed against, it would make you think again. You think it through. You have to be the first. The witnesses said, this man did it. You've also got to be the one to do the execution. These escaped it because the Romans were going to do it. They weren't allowed to execute anybody at this time. The Romans had to do it. They couldn't find two. False witnesses came. They couldn't make it stick. In the end, they broke their own law and said, aren't you going to say anything? Jesus held his peace. And eventually he said, I adjure thee, verse 63, by the living God, that you tell us whether you be the Christ, the Son of God. I want you to tell us. And Jesus said unto him, thou hast said. Now that is a form of words which in our understanding means, well, that's your words. You said that, not me. We could say, but that's not what he meant. When he said, thou hast said, what he was saying is not like our words, that's what you say. It's in there, in this language, it means, what you have said is true. That's what it means. He's saying, you are right. He's not saying, you said it, not me. He's saying, you are right. You have said it. And I do not contradict you. And because he said that, he admitted to being Christ, the Son of God. Jesus then says, and he quotes virtually Daniel. Verse Verse 64, nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. And he quotes Daniel, which is a prophecy of the Messiah, that he would come with the clouds. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? And they all condemned him. Verse 66, what think you? They answered and said, he is guilty of death. There's the sentence of men. God is guilty of death. It was their judgment. What they were doing was condemning themselves. It wasn't the final word. Let me just give you a further word on this. This is in Acts chapter, and we're going to come back in a moment. Just let me just quote this to you. This is in chapter 3, verse 14. You denied the Holy One and the just and desired a murderer to be granted to you and killed the Prince of Life. All right? Verse 14, 15. Verse 26. Unto you first, God, having raised up his Son Jesus, sent him to bless you. It's amazing, isn't it? You did this, you did that, and to you first, God, having raised up his Son, has sent him to bless you. All right, back to chapter 26. That's just a... He wasn't speaking, by the way, to the high priests. He wasn't speaking to Caiaphas. He was speaking to the people. But that's the word he said. Chapter 26. And so he's guilty of death. Then verse 67 is this unbelievable point. Then, when they'd condemned him to death, they did spit upon him. Why? There's no need for that. No need. They violently mistreated him. They spit in his face and buffeted him. I think this is the point of the story, of the account, that you shake your head and think, why? Why? Now think of him. You'll see him one day. You love him now because you've not seen him. But think of what they did. They spat in his face. They began to violently mistreat him. They beat him, they smote him with the palms of their hands. Now, they didn't just go a tap. You know, you see some tap like this. They hit him. And they said, now you prophesy to us. It's this unbelievable. The cross is one thing. To reject him is one thing. But this is it. It's this bitter, violent reaction against him. And Peter's watching this, and he's observing this. And you know this, I'm not going to take long on this. We can virtually finish now. But the point is, here he is, he's caught. And Jesus says, before the cock crows twice. I know he didn't say that in this gospel, but he says it. That before the cock crows twice, you shall deny me thrice. In other words, he said, the cock shall crow more than once. And what you have is, that he denied the Lord, and then he hears a cock crowing. If you've ever heard a cock crowing, you'll know what this is. When do the cocks crow? They crow very early in the morning. They wake you up. And, you know, you think, well, that's the point when you don't like cocks. If you don't want to wake up. I remember staying with Alan Turnbull in his place in Cameroon, and he had a cock, and it perched in a tree outside my bedroom window. And I just hope we'd have chicken for the dinner that day. But, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, there it was, cock-a-doodle-doo. And there you are, in your bed. Oh, thank you. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, cock-a-doodle-doo. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, you feel like going out and... anyway. But the point is, if you've ever been in a country that is where, or a farm, or a third world country where they all keep chickens, and you're there in the midst of all these houses in the morning, 5 o'clock, all the cocks crowing over the town, all around, all is there. You remember it probably from Nepal if you've been there. All the cocks crow, and you're there. But the point is Peter early in the morning. He denies the Lord. And then he hears the cock crow. Remember, he hears it. And remember what the cock says to you. It says, wake up. Wake up. Don't sleep. Wake up. And he didn't wake up. He continued in his way. He didn't wake up. Did he not hear it? Because it didn't crow only once. He heard it at least twice. Did he not hear it? God virtually said to him, Peter, I'm going to give you 3 chances. Between them you'll hear a cock crowing. In other words, you must wake up. If God says to you, you must not do this, you must leave this course, and I am going to speak to you about it more than once. I'm going to warn you on the course of it. Peter even denied that it was possible. There are many men who have said, I will never commit that sin. I will never be tempted in that. You watch it. You watch your heart. And when the tempting begins, you wake up quick. And you listen to that cock crowing. Or you'll do it 3 times. The wonderful thing is in this course of this story that he did wake up in the end. And that he didn't walk out on Jesus Christ forever. This was his hour of great temptation. It was the hour when Satan wanted to utterly destroy him. How would he have destroyed him? Because when he'd done this, he would have so rubbed his face in it, he would never have been able to believe in God again. You've sinned. Satan says, no, I'm going to so rub your face in your sin, you'll never believe in God again. Sin is one danger. To be swallowed up with sorrow over that sin is a greater danger, if I can put it that way. You may fail. Don't give up. Do not give up your faith. God will forgive you and restore you, and you will be able to put it all the way behind you. It will be gone. One day you will preach, and you find Peter preaching in that same chapter 3, and we've just quoted it in fact. He says, you denied! How dare he say it? He could have said, and I did too, but I am through it. You understand, he knows the power of conversion. He could say, you adulterers! But he said, I was too, but God's converted me. And I'm free of it. The point of the gospel is not that you say, you horrible sinner, and I've always been perfect. Of course you've not. But that he so got free from that failure that he could stand there and say, you denied him. Knowing that he denied him, but God had set him free from it and forgiven him. But here he is, and he's cursed and he's sworn, and it's all awful. And the cock crows, and it's almost like the God has put a sign in his way that he can't miss. Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! And then the last time, he woke up. He realized where he was. He realized what he was doing. He realized that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And his heart wasn't able to bear it. And he was getting into deeper and deeper water. And he woke up. And he went out and he wept bitterly. And as his heart broke, even that breaking was grace, you see. Jesus said, I've prayed for you that your faith fail not. He wept. And as he wept, his faith didn't fail. He wept, and somehow, as he was leaving, Jesus looked at him. And I believe with all my heart that as he looked at him, Peter saw something that was a lifeline for him. I can't say what it was, but he just saw it. I still love you. I can't put it in words because I don't know what he would have seen in his face. But he would have known as he looked on Jesus' face. He just gave him a look right through all the crowd and how far away it was. But he said, don't worry, I still love you. It hasn't stopped my love. You know, when I read this account of this whole thing, I am so glad I was not there. Peter was a wonderful man. I'm glad I wasn't tempted on that day. Let's pray.